Chapter 3. When Shevik woke, having slept straight through his first morning on Urus, his nose was stuffy, his throat was sore, and he coughed a lot. He thought he had a cold. Even Odonian hygiene had not outwitted the common cold. But the doctor who was waiting to check him over, a dignified, elderly man, said it was more like a massive hay fever, an allergic reaction to the foreign dusts and pollens of Urus. He issued pills and a shot, which Shevik accepted patiently, and a tray of lunch, which Shevik accepted hungrily. The doctor asked him to stay in his apartment and left him. As soon as he had finished eating, he commenced his exploration of Urus, room by room. The bed, a massive bed on four legs, with a mattress far softer than that of the bunk on the Mindful, and complex bedclothes, some silky and some warm and thick, and a lot of pillows like cumulus clouds, had a room all to itself. The floor was covered with springy carpeting. There was a chest of drawers of beautifully carved and polished wood, and a closet big enough to hold the clothing of a 10-man dormitory. Then there was the great common room with the fireplace, which he had seen last night, and a third room, which contained a bathtub, a washstand, and an elaborate shit stool. This room was evidently for his sole use, as it opened off the bedroom and contained only one of each kind of fixture, though each was of a sensuous luxury that far surpassed mere eroticism, and partook, in Shevik's view, of a kind of ultimate apotheosis of the excremental. He spent nearly an hour in his third room, employing all the fixtures in turn, and getting very clean in the process. The deployment of water was wonderful. Faucets stayed on till turned off. The bathtub must hold 60 liters, and the stool used at least 5 liters in flushing. This was really not surprising. The surface of Urus was 5/6 water. Even its deserts were deserts of ice at the poles. No need to economize, no drought. But what became of the shit? He brooded over this, kneeling by the stool after investigating its mechanism. They must filter it out of the water at a manure plant. There were seaside communities on Anaris that used such a system for reclamation. He intended to ask about this, but never got around to it. There were many questions he never did ask on Urus. Despite his stuffy head, he felt well and restless. The rooms were so warm that he put off getting dressed and stalked about them naked. He went to the windows of the big room and stood looking out. The room was high. He was startled at first and drew back, unused to being in a building of more than one story. It was like looking down from a dirigible. One felt detached from the ground, dominant, uninvolved. The windows looked right over a grove of trees, to a white building with a graceful square tower. Beyond this building, the land fell away to a broad valley. All of it was farmed, for the innumerable patches of green that colored it were rectangular. Even where the green faded into blue distance, the dark lines of lanes, hedgerows, or trees could still be made out, a network as fine as the nervous system of a living body. At last, hills rose up bordering the valley, blue fold behind blue fold, soft and dark under the even, pale gray of the sky. It was the most beautiful view Shevik had ever seen. The tenderness and vitality of the colors, the mixture of rectilinear human design and powerful, proliferate natural contours, the variety and harmony of the elements, gave an impression of complex wholeness such as he had never seen, except, perhaps, foreshadowed on a small scale in certain serene and thoughtful human faces. Compared to this, every scene Anaris could offer, even the plain of Abani and the gorges of the Ne-Thera, was meager, barren, arid, and inchoate. The deserts of Southwest had a vast beauty, but it was hostile and timeless. Even where men farmed Anaris most closely, their landscape was like a crude sketch in yellow chalk, compared with this fulfilled magnificence of life, rich in the sense of history and of seasons to come, inexhaustible. This is what a world is supposed to look like, Shevik thought. And somewhere, out in that blue and green splendor, something was singing. A small voice, high up, starting and ceasing, incredibly sweet. What was it? A little, sweet, wild voice, a music in midair. He listened, and his breath caught in his throat. There was a knock at the door. Turning naked and wondering from the window, Shevik said, "Come in." A man entered, carrying packages. He stopped just inside the door. Shevik crossed the room, saying his own name, Anaresti style, and Urasti style, holding out his hand. The man, who was 50 or so, with a lined, worn face, said something Shevik did not understand a word of, and did not shake hands. Perhaps he was prevented by the packages, but he made no effort to shift them and free his hands. His face was extremely grave. It was possible that he was embarrassed. Shevik, who thought he had at least mastered Urasti customs of greeting, was nonplussed. "Come on in," he repeated, and then added, since the Urasti were forever using titles and honorifics, "Sir?" The man went off into another unintelligible speech, sidling meantime towards the bedroom. Shevik caught several words of Iotic this time, but could make no sense of the rest. He let the fellow go, since he seemed to want to get to the bedroom. Perhaps he was a roommate. But there was only one bed. Shevik gave him up and went back to the window, and the man scuttled on into the bedroom and thumped around in it for a few minutes. Just as Shevik had decided that he was a night worker who used the bedroom days, an arrangement sometimes made in temporarily overcrowded domiciles, he came out again. He said something. "There you are, sir, perhaps," and ducked his head in a curious fashion, as if he thought that Shevik, 5 meters away, was about to hit him in the face. He left. Shevik stood by the windows, slowly realizing that he had, for the first time in his life, been bowed to. He went into the bedroom and discovered that the bed had been made. Slowly, thoughtfully, he got dressed. He was putting on his shoes when the next knock came. A group entered, in a different manner, in a normal manner, it seemed to Shevik, as if they had a right to be there, or anywhere they chose to be. The man with the packages had been hesitant. He had almost slunk in. And yet his face, and his hands, and his clothing had come closer to Shevik's notion of a normal human being's appearance than did those of the new visitors. The slinking man had behaved strangely, but he had looked like an Anaresti. These four behaved like Anaresti, but looked, with their shaven faces and gorgeous clothes, like creatures of an alien species. Shevik managed to recognize one of them as Pai, and the others as men who had been with him all last evening. He explained that he had not caught their names, and they reintroduced themselves, smiling. Dr. Chafoilisk, Dr. Oie, and Dr. Atro. "Oh, by damn," Shevik said. "Atro, I am glad to meet you." He put his hands on the old man's shoulders and kissed his cheek, before thinking that this brotherly greeting, common enough on Anaris, might not be acceptable here. Atro, however, embraced him heartily in return and looked up into his face with filmy gray eyes. Shevik realized that he was nearly blind. "My dear Shevik," he said, "welcome to AEO. Welcome to Urus. Welcome home. So many years we've written letters, destroyed each other's theories. You were always the better destroyer. Here, hold on, I've got something for you." The old man felt about in his pockets. Under his velvety university gown, he wore a jacket. Under that, a vest. Under that, a shirt, and probably another layer under that. All of these garments and his trousers contained pockets. Shevik watched quite fascinated as Atro went through 6 or 7 pockets, all containing belongings, before he came up with a small cube of yellow metal mounted on a bit of polished wood. "There," he said, peering at it, "your award. The C.O. Owen Prize, you know. The cash is in your account. Here, 9 years late, but better late than never." His hands trembled as he handed the thing to Shevik. It was heavy. The yellow cube was solid gold. Shevik stood motionless, holding it.
"I don't know about you young men," said Atro, "but I'm going to sit down."
They all sat down in the deep, soft chairs, which Shevik had already examined, puzzled by the material with which they were covered. A non-woven brown stuff that felt like skin.
"How old were you 9 years ago, Shevik?"
Atro was the foremost living physicist on Urus. There was about him not only the dignity of age, but also the blunt self-assurance of one accustomed to respect. This was nothing new to Shevik. Atro had precisely the one kind of authority that Shevik recognized. Also, it gave him pleasure to be addressed at last simply by his name.
"I was 29 when I finished the principles, Atro."
29? Good God! That makes you the youngest recipient of the C.O. Owen for a century or so. Didn't get around to giving me mine till I was 60 or so. How old were you then when you first wrote me?"
"About 20.
Atro snorted.
"Took you for a man of 40 then.
What about Sabul?" Oie inquired. Oie was even shorter than most Arasti, who all seemed short to Shevik. He had a flat, bland face and oval jet-black eyes. "There was a period of 6 or 8 years when you never wrote, and Sabul kept in touch with us, but he never has talked on your radio link-up with us. We've wondered what your relationship is."
"Sabul is the senior member of the Avani Institute in Physics," said Shevik. "I used to work with him."
"An older rival, jealous, meddled with your books, been clear enough. We hardly need an explanation, Oye," said the fourth man, Chifoilisk, in a harsh voice.
He was middle-aged, a swarthy, stocky man with the fine hands of a desk worker. He was the only one of them whose face was not completely shaven. He had left the chin bristling to match his short, iron-gray head hair.
"No need to pretend that all you Odonian brothers are full of brotherly love," he said. "Human nature is human nature."
Shivik's lack of response was saved from seeming significant by a volley of sneezes.
"I do not have a handkerchief," he apologized, wiping his eyes.
"Take mine," said Atro,
and produced a snowy handkerchief from one of his many pockets. Shevik took it, and as he did so, an importunate memory wrung his heart. He thought of his daughter, Sadik, a little dark-eyed girl, saying, "You can share the handkerchief I use." That memory, which was very dear to him, was unbearably painful now. Trying to escape it, he smiled at random and said, "I am allergic to your planet. The doctor says this."
"Good God, you won't be sneezing like that permanently,"
old Atro asked, peering at him.
"Hasn't your man been in yet?" said Paye.
"My man?" "The servant. He was supposed to bring you some things, handkerchiefs included, just enough to tide you over till you can shop for yourself. Nothing choice. I'm afraid there's very little choice in ready-made clothes for a man your height."
When Shevik had sorted this out, Paye spoke in a rapid drawl, which matched with his soft, handsome features. He said,
"That is kind of you. I feel..." He looked at Atro. "I am, you know, the beggar man," he said to the old man, as he had said to Dr. Kamoi on the Mindful. "I could not bring money. We do not use it. I could not bring gifts.
We use nothing that you lack. So I come, like a good Adonian, with empty hands. Atro and Paie assured him that he was a guest. There was no question of payment. It was their privilege.
Besides, Chifoilisk said in his sour voice, the Iadi government puts the bill.
Paie gave him a sharp glance, but Chifoilisk, instead of returning it, looked straight at Shevik. On his swarthy face was an expression that he made no effort to hide, but which Shevik could not interpret. Warning or complicity?
There speaks the unregenerate Thuvian, old Atro said with his snort. But you mean to say, Shevik, that you brought nothing at all with you? No papers? No new work? I was looking forward to a book. Another revolution in physics. See these pushy young fellows stood on their heads the way you stood me with the principles. What have you been working on?
Well, I have been reading Paie, Dr. Paie's paper on the block universe, on paradox and relativity.
All very well. Sayo's our current star, no doubt of that. Least of all in his own mind, eh, Sayo? But what's that to do with the price of cheese? Where's your general temporal theory?
In my head, said Shevik with a broad, genial smile. There was a very little pause. Oie asked him if he had seen the work on relativity theory by an alien physicist, Einstein of Terra. Shevik had not. They were intensely interested in it, except for Atro, who had outlived intensity. Paie ran off to his room to get Shevik a copy of the translation. It's several hundred years old, but there's fresh ideas in it for us, he said.
Maybe, said Atro, but none of these off-worlders can follow our physics. The Hainish call it materialism, and the Terrans call it mysticism, and then they both give up. Don't let this fad for everything alien sidetrack you, Shevik. They've got nothing for us. Dig your own pigweed, as my father used to say.
He gave his senile snort and levered himself up out of the chair.
Come on out for a turn in the grove with me. No wonder you're stuffy, cooped up in here.
The doctor says I'm to stay in this room 3 days. I might be infected? Infectious?
Never pay any attention to doctors, my dear fellow.
Perhaps in this case, though, Dr. Atro, Paie suggested in his easy, conciliating voice.
After all, the doctor's from the government, isn't he? Said Chifoilisk with evident malice. Best man they could find, I'm sure, Atro said, unsmiling, and took his leave without urging Shevik further.
Chifoilisk went with him. The two younger men stayed with Shevik, talking physics for a long time. With immense pleasure and with that same sense of profound recognition, of finding something the way it was meant to be, Shevik discovered for the first time in his life the conversation of his equals. Midas, though a splendid teacher, had never been able to follow him into the new areas of theory that he had, with her encouragement, begun to explore. Kvarub was the only person he had met whose training and ability were comparable to his own, and he and Kvarub had met too late, at the very end of her life. Since those days, Shevik had worked with many people of talent, but because he had never been a full-time member of the Abenai Institute, he had never been able to take them far enough. They remained bogged down in the old problems, the classical sequency physics. He had no equals. Here, in the realm of inequity, he met them at last. It was a revelation, a liberation. Physicists, mathematicians, astronomers, logicians, biologists, all here at the university. And they came to him, or he went to them, and they talked, and new worlds were born of their talking. It is the nature of idea to be communicated, written, spoken, done. The idea is like grass. It craves light, likes crowds, thrives on crossbreeding, grows better for being stepped on. Even on that first afternoon at the university, with Oie and Paie, he knew he had found something he had longed for ever since. As boys, on a boyish level, he and Turin and Bedap had used to talk half the night, teasing and daring each other into always bolder flights of mind. He vividly remembered some of those nights. He saw Turin saying, "If we knew what Urus was really like, maybe some of us would want to go there." And he had been so shocked by the idea that he had jumped all over Turin, and Tyr had backed down at once. He had always backed down. Poor damned soul. And he had always been right. Conversation had stopped. Paie and Oie were silent. "I'm sorry," he said. "The head is heavy." "How's the gravity?" Paie asked, with the charming smile of a man who, like a bright child, counts on his charm. "I don't notice," Shevik said. "Only in the... what is this?" "Knees. Knee joints." "Yes, knees. Function is impaired. But I will get accustomed." He looked at Paie, then at Oie. "There is a question. But I don't wish to give offense." "Never fear, sir," Paie said. Oie said, "I'm not sure you know how." Oie was not a likable fellow like Paie. Even talking physics, he had an evasive, secretive style. And yet beneath the style, there was something Shevik felt, to trust. Whereas beneath Paie's charm, what was there? Well, no matter. He had to trust them all, and would. "Where are women?" Paie laughed. Oie smiled and asked, "In what sense?" "All senses. I met women at the party last night, 5, 10, hundreds of men. None were scientists, I think." "Who were they?" "Wives. One of them was my wife, in fact," Oie said with his secretive smile. "Where are other women?" "Oh, no difficulty at all there, sir," Paie said promptly. "Just tell us your preferences, and nothing could be simpler to provide." "One does hear some picturesque speculations about Anoresti customs, but I rather think we can come up with almost anything you had in mind," said Oie. Shevik had no idea what they were talking about. He scratched his head. "Are all the scientists here men, then?" "Scientists?" Oie asked, incredulous. Paie coughed. "Scientists? Oh yes, certainly, they're all men. There are some female teachers in the girls' schools, of course, but they never get past certificate level." "Why not?" "Can't do the math. No head for abstract thought. Don't belong. You know how it is. What women call thinking is done with the uterus. Of course, there's always a few exceptions. God-awful, brainy women with vaginal atrophy." "You Odonians let women study science?" Oie inquired. "Well, they are in the sciences, yes." "Not many, I hope." "Well, about half." "I've always said," said Paie, "that girl technicians properly handled could take a good deal of the load off the men in any laboratory situation. They're actually defter and quicker than men at repetitive tasks, and more docile, less easily bored. We could free men for original work much sooner if we used women." "Not in my lab, you won't," said Oie. "Keep them in their place." "Do you find any women capable of original intellectual work, Dr. Shevik?" "Well, it was more that they found me. Midis in North Setting was my teacher. Also Gvarab. You know of her, I think." "Gvarab was a woman?" Paie said in genuine surprise, and laughed. Oie looked unconvinced and offended. "Can't tell from your names, of course," he said coldly. "You make a point, I suppose.
of drawing no distinction between the sexes. Shivik said mildly, Odo was a woman. There you have it, Oye said. He did not shrug, but he very nearly shrugged. Paye looked respectful and nodded, just as he did when old Atro maundered. Shivik saw that he had touched in these men an impersonal animosity that went very deep. Apparently they, like the tables on the ship, contained a woman, a suppressed, silenced, bestialized woman, a fury in a cage. He had no right to tease them. They knew no relation but possession. They were possessed. A beautiful, virtuous woman, Paye said, is an inspiration to us, the most precious thing on earth. Shivik felt extremely uncomfortable. He got up and went over to the windows. Your world is very beautiful, he said. I wish I could see more. While I must stay inside, will you give me books? Of course, sir. What sort? History, pictures, stories, anything. Maybe they should be books for children. You see, I know very little. We learn about Urus, but mostly about Odo's times. Before that was 8,500 years. And then, since the settlement of Anaris is a century and a half, since the last ship brought the last settlers. Ignorance. We ignore you, you ignore us. You are our history. We are perhaps your future. I want to learn, not to ignore. It is the reason I came. We must know each other. We are not primitive men. Our morality is no longer tribal. It cannot be. Such ignorance is a wrong from which wrong will arise. So, I come to learn. He spoke very earnestly. Paye assented with enthusiasm. Exactly, sir. We are all in complete agreement with your aims. Oye looked at him from those black, opaque, oval eyes, and said, Then you come, essentially, as an emissary of your society? Shivik returned to sit on the marble seat by the hearth, which he already felt as his seat, his territory. He wanted a territory. He felt the need for caution, but he felt more strongly the need that had brought him across the dry abyss from the other world, the need for communication, the wish to unbuild walls. I come, he said carefully, as a syndic of the Syndicate of Initiative, the group that talks with Urus on the radio these last 2 years. But I am not, you know, an ambassador from any authority, any institution. I hope you did not ask me as that. No, Oye said. We asked you, Shivik the physicist, with the approval of our government and the Council of World Governments, of course. But you are here as the private guest of AUN University. Good. But we haven't been sure whether or not you came with the approval of... He hesitated. Shivik grinned. Of my government? We know that nominally there's no government on Anaris. However, obviously there's administration. And we gather that the group that sent you, your syndicate, is a kind of faction, perhaps a revolutionary faction. Everybody on Anaris is a revolutionary, Oye. The network of administration and management is called PDC, Production and Distribution Coordination. They are a coordinating system for all syndicates, federatives, and individuals who do productive work. They do not govern persons, they administer production. They have no authority either to support me or to prevent me. They can only tell us the public opinion of us, where we stand in the social conscience. That's what you want to know? Well, my friends and I are mostly disapproved of. Most people on Anaris don't want to learn about Urus. They fear it and want nothing to do with proper Terrians. I am sorry if I am rude. It is the same here with some people, is it not? The contempt,
the fear, the tribalism. Well, so I came to begin to change that.
Entirely on your own initiative, said Oye.
It is the only initiative I acknowledge, Shevik said, smiling, in dead earnest. He spent the next couple of days talking with the scientists who came to see him, reading the books Paye brought him, and sometimes simply standing at the double-arched windows to gaze at the coming of summer to the Great Valley, and to listen for the brief, sweet conversations out there in the open air. Birds. He knew the singer's name now, and what they looked like from pictures in the books. But still, when he heard the song or caught the flash of wings from tree to tree, he stood in wonder like a child. He had expected to feel so strange here on Urus, so lost, alien, and confused, and he felt nothing of the kind. Of course, there were endless things he did not understand. He only glimpsed, now, how many things. This whole incredibly complex society, with all its nations, classes, castes, cults, customs, and its magnificent, appalling, and interminable history. And each individual he met was a puzzle, full of surprises. But they were not the gross, cold egoists he had expected them to be. They were as complex and various as their culture, as their landscape. And they were intelligent, and they were kind. They treated him like a brother. They did all they could to make him feel not lost, not alien, but at home. And he did feel at home. He could not help it. The whole world, the softness of the air, the fall of sunlight across the hills, the very pull of the heavier gravity on his body, asserted to him that this was home indeed. His race's world, and all its beauty, was his birthright. The silence, the utter silence of Anaris. He thought of it at night. No birds sang there. There were no voices there but human voices, silence, and the barren lands. On the third day, old Atro brought him a pile of newspapers. Paye, who was Shevik's very frequent companion, said nothing to Atro, but when the old man left, he told Shevik, "Awful trash, those papers, sir. Amusing, but don't believe anything you read in them." Shevik took up the topmost paper. It was badly printed on coarse paper, the first crudely made artifact he had handled on Urus. In fact, it looked like the PDC bulletins and regional reports that served as newspapers on Anaris. But its style was very different from those smudgy, practical, factual publications. It was full of exclamation points and pictures. There was a picture of Shevik in front of the spaceship, with Paye holding his arm and scowling. "First man from the moon," said the huge print over the picture. Fascinated, Shevik read on. His first step on Earth. Urus's first visitor from the Anaris settlement in 170 years. Dr. Shevik was photographed yesterday at his arrival on the regular moon freighter run at Payer Spaceport. The distinguished scientist, winner of the Seo Owen Prize for service to all nations through science, has accepted a professorship at AUN University, an honor never before accorded to an off-worlder. Asked about his feelings on first viewing Urus, the tall, distinguished physicist replied, "It is a great honor to be invited to your beautiful planet. I hope that a new era of all Setian friendship is now beginning, when the twin planets will move forward together in brotherhood." "But I never said anything," Shevik protested to Paye. "Of course not. We didn't let that lot get near you. That doesn't cramp a birdseed journalist's imagination. They'll report you as saying what they want you to say, no matter what you do say or don't." Shevik chewed his lip. "Well," he said at last, "if I had said anything, it would have been like that. But what is all Setian?" "The Terrans call us Setians, From their word for our son, I believe. The popular press has picked it up lately. There's a sort of fad for the word.
Then all Sedian means Urus and Inaris together?
I suppose so, Paye said with marked lack of interest.
Shevik went on reading the papers. He read that he was a towering giant of a man, that he was unshaven and possessed a mane, whatever that was, of graying hair, that he was 37, 43, and 56, that he had written a great work of physics called The Spelling Depended on the Paper, Principles of Simultaneity, or Principles of Simultaneity, that he was a goodwill ambassador from the Odonian government, that he was a vegetarian, and that, like all Anaresti, he did not drink. At this he broke down and laughed till his ribs hurt. By damn, they do have imagination. Do they think we live on water vapor, like the rock moss?
They mean you don't drink alcoholic liquors, said Paye, also laughing. The one thing everybody knows about Odonians, I suppose, is that you don't drink alcohol.
Is it true, by the way?
Some people distill alcohol from fermented holum root for drinking. They say it gives the unconscious free play, like brainwave training. Most people prefer that. It's very easy and doesn't cause a disease. Is that common here?
Drinking is. I don't know about this disease. What's it called?
Alcoholism, I think.
Oh, I see. But what do working people do on Inaris for a bit of jollity, to escape the woes of the world together for a night?
Shevik looked blank.
Well, I don't know. Perhaps our woes are inescapable.
Quaint, Paye said, and smiled disarmingly.
Shevik pursued his reading. One of the journals was in a language he did not know, and one in a different alphabet altogether.
The one was from Thu, Paye explained, and the other from Benbili, a nation in the Western Hemisphere.
The paper from Thu was well-printed and sober in format. Paye explained that it was a government publication.
Here in AEO, you see, educated people get their news from the telefax and radio and television and the weekly reviews. These papers are read by the lower classes almost exclusively, written by semi-literates for semi-literates, as you can see. We have complete freedom of the press in AEO, which inevitably means we get a lot of trash. The Thuvian paper is much better written, but it reports only those facts which the Thuvian Central Presidium wants reported. Censorship is absolute in Thu. The state is all, and all for the state. Hardly the place for an Odonian, sir?
And this paper?
I really have no idea. Benbili's a backward sort of country, always having revolutions.
A group of people in Benbili sent us a message on the syndicate wavelength, not long before I left Abenai. They call themselves Odonians.
Are there any such groups here, in AEO?
Not that I ever heard of, Dr. Shevik.
The wall. Shevik knew the wall by now, when he came up against it. The wall was this young man's charm, courtesy, indifference.
I think you are afraid of me, Paye, he said abruptly and genially.
Afraid of you, sir?
Because I am, by my existence, disproof of the necessity of the state.
But what is to fear?
I will not hurt you, Sayo Paye, you know. I am personally quite harmless.
Listen, I am not a doctor. We do not use titles. I am called Shevik.
I know. I'm sorry, sir. In our terms, you see, it seems disrespectful. It just doesn't seem right.
He apologized winningly, expecting forgiveness.
Can you not recognize me as an equal? Shevik asked, watching him without either forgiveness or anger.
Paye was for once nonplussed.
But really, sir, you are, you know, a very important man.
There is no reason why you should change your habits for me, Shevik said.
It does not matter.
I thought you might be glad to be free of the unnecessary, that's all.
3 days of confinement indoors left Shevik charged with surplus energy,
and when he was released, he wore out his escorts in his first eagerness to see everything at once. They took him over the university, which was a city in itself, 16,000 students and faculty, with its dormitories, refectories, theaters, meeting rooms, and so on. It was not very different from an Odonian community, except that it was very old, was exclusively male, was incredibly luxurious, and was not organized federatively, but hierarchically, from the top down. All the same, Shevik thought, it felt like a community. He had to remind himself of the differences. He was driven out into the country in hired cars, splendid machines of bizarre elegance. There were not many of them on the roads. The hire was expensive, and few people owned a car privately, because they were heavily taxed. All such luxuries, which, if freely allowed to the public, would tend to drain irreplaceable natural resources or to foul the environment with waste products, were strictly controlled by regulation and taxation. His guides dwelt on this with some pride. Aeo had led the world for centuries, they said, in ecological control and the husbanding of natural resources. The excesses of the 9th millennium were ancient history, their only lasting effect being the shortage of certain metals, which, fortunately, could be imported from the moon. Traveling by car or train, he saw villages, farms, towns, fortresses from the feudal days, the ruined towers of age, ancient capital of an empire, 4,400 years old. He saw the farmlands, lakes, and hills of Avan province, the heartland of Aeo, and on the northern skyline, the peaks of the Meitei Range, white, gigantic. The beauty of the land and the well-being of its people remained a perpetual marvel to him. The guides were right. The Urasti knew how to use their world. He had been taught as a child that Urus was a festering mass of iniquity, and waste. But all the people he met, and all the people he saw, in the smallest country village, were well-dressed, well-fed, and, contrary to his expectations, industrious. They did not stand about sullenly, waiting to be ordered to do things. Just like Anaresti, they were simply busy getting things done. It puzzled him. He had assumed that if you removed a human being's natural incentive to work, his initiative, his spontaneous creative energy, and replaced it with external motivation and coercion, he would become a lazy and careless worker. But no careless workers kept those lovely farmlands, or made the superb cars and comfortable trains. The lure and compulsion of profit was, evidently, a much more effective replacement of the natural initiative than he had been led to believe. He would have liked to talk to some of those sturdy, self-respecting-looking people he saw in the small towns, to ask them, for instance, if they considered themselves to be poor. For if these were the poor, he had to revise his understanding of the word. But there never seemed to be time, with all his guides wanted him to see. The other big cities of Aeo were too distant to be reached in a day's tour, but he was taken to Neo-Isaia, 50 kilometers from the university, frequently. A whole series of receptions in his honor was held there. He did not enjoy these much. They were not at all his idea of a party. Everyone was very polite and talked a great deal, but not about anything interesting. And they smiled so much, they looked anxious. But their clothes were gorgeous. Indeed, they seemed to put all the lightheartedness their manner lacked into their clothes and their food, and all the different things they drank, and the lavish furnishings and ornaments of the rooms in the palaces where the receptions were held. He was shown the sights of Neo-Isaia, a city of 5 million, a quarter of the population of his whole planet. They took him to Capitol Square and showed him the high bronze doors of the Directorate, the seat of the government of Aeo. He was permitted to witness a debate in the Senate and a committee meeting of the directors. They took him to the zoo, the National Museum, the Museum of Science and Industry. They took him to a school where charming children in blue and white uniforms sang the national anthem of AEO for him. They took him through an electronic parts factory, a fully automated steel mill, and a nuclear fusion plant, so that he could see how efficiently a proprietarian economy ran its manufacturing and power supply. They took him through a new housing development put up by the government, so that he could see how the state looked after its people. They took him on a boat tour down the Suez estuary, crowded with shipping from all over the planet, to the sea. They took him to the high courts of law, and he spent a whole day listening to civil and criminal cases being tried, an experience that left him bewildered and appalled. But they insisted that he should see what there was to be seen and be taken wherever he wanted to go. When he asked, with some diffidence, if he might see the place where Odo was buried, they whisked him straight to the old cemetery in the Trans-Sua district. They even allowed newsmen from the disreputable papers to photograph him standing there, in the shade of the great old willows, looking at the plain, well-kept tombstone. Laia Asieo Odo, 698-769. To be whole is to be part. True voyage is return. He was taken to Rho Dared, the seat of the Council of World Governments, to address the plenary council of that body. He had hoped to meet, or at least see, aliens there, the ambassadors from Terra, or from Hain, but the schedule of events was too tightly planned to permit this. He had worked hard on his speech, a plea for free communication and mutual recognition between the New World and the Old. It was received with a 10-minute standing ovation. The respectable weeklies commented on it with approval, calling it a disinterested moral gesture of human brotherhood by a great scientist. But they did not quote from it, nor did the popular papers. In fact, despite the ovation, Shevek had the curious feeling that nobody had heard it. He was given many privileges and entrees to the light research laboratories, the National Archives, the Nuclear Technology Laboratories, the National Library in NEO, the Accelerator in Mayafed, the Space Research Foundation in DRIO. Though everything he saw on Urus made him want to see more, still several weeks of the tourist life was enough. It was all so fascinating, startling, and marvelous that at last it became quite overwhelming. He wanted to settle down at the university and work, and think it all over for a while. But for a last day's sightseeing, he asked to be shown around the Space Research Foundation. Paye looked very pleased when he made this request. Much that he had seen recently was awesome to him because it was so old, centuries old, even millennia. The foundation, on the contrary, was new, built within the last 10 years in the lavish, elegant style of the times. The architecture was dramatic. Great masses of color were used. Heights and distances were exaggerated. The laboratories were spacious and airy. The attached factories and machine shops were housed behind splendid neo-Saiton porticos of arches and columns. The hangars were huge, multicolored domes, translucent and fantastic. The men who worked there were, in contrast, very quiet and solid. They took Shevek away from his usual escorts and showed him through the whole foundation, including every stage of the experimental interstellar propulsion system they were working on, from the computers and the drawing boards to a half-finished ship, enormous and surreal in the orange, violet, and yellow light within the vast geodesic hangar. "You have so much," Shevek said to the engineer who had taken charge of him, a man named Oegeo. "You have so much to work with, and you work with it so well. This is magnificent. The coordination, the cooperation, the greatness of the enterprise. Couldn't swing anything on this scale where you come from, hmm?" the engineer said, grinning. "Spaceships? Our space fleet is the ships the settlers came in from Urus, built here on Urus nearly 2 centuries ago. To build just a ship to carry grain across the sea, a barge. It takes a year's planning, a big effort of our economy." Oegeo nodded. Well, we've got the goods all right. But you know, you're the man who can tell us when to scrap this whole job. Throw it all away.
Throw it all away? What do you mean?
Faster than light travel, Oegeo said.
Transilience.
The old physics says it's impossible. The Terrans say it isn't possible. But the Hainish, who after all invented the drive we use now, say that it is possible. Only they don't know how to do it, because they're just learning temporal physics from us. Evidently, if it's in anybody's pocket, anybody in the known worlds, Dr. Shevik, it's in yours.
Shevik looked at him with a distancing stare, his light eyes hard and clear.
I am a theoretician, Oegeo, not a designer. If you provide the theory, the unification of sequency and simultaneity in a general field theory of time, then we'll design the ships and arrive on Terra or Hain or the next galaxy in the instant we leave Urus. This tub, and he looked down the hangar at the looming framework of the half-built ship swimming in shafts of violet and orange light, will be as outdated as an ox cart.
You dream as you build, superbly, Shevik said, still withdrawn and stern. There was much more that Oegeo and the others wanted to show him and discuss with him. But before long, he said, with a simplicity that precluded any ironic intention, I think you had better take me back to the Keepers. They did so. They bade farewell with mutual warmth. Shevik got into the car and then got out again. I was forgetting, he said. Is there time to see one other thing in Drio?
There isn't anything else in Drio, Paye said, polite as ever, and trying hard to hide his annoyance over Shevik's five-hour escapade among the engineers.
I should like to see the fort.
What fort, sir?
An old castle from the times of the kings.
It was used later as a prison. Anything like that would have been torn down. The foundation rebuilt the town entirely.
When they were in the car and the chauffeur was closing the doors, Chifoyalisk, another probable source of Paye's ill humor, asked,
What did you want to see another castle for, Shevik? Should have thought you'd had enough old ruins to hold you for a while.
The fort in Drio was where Odo spent 9 years, Shevik replied. His face was set, as it had been since he talked with Oegeo. After the insurrection of 747, she wrote the prison letters there, and the analogy.
Afraid it's been pulled down, Paye said sympathetically.
Drio was a moribund sort of town, and the foundation just wiped out and started fresh.
Shevik nodded. But as the car followed a riverside highway toward the turnoff to AUN, it passed a bluff on the curve of the River Seisa. And up on the bluff, there was a building, heavy, ruinous, implacable, with broken towers of black stone. Nothing could have been less like the gorgeous, lighthearted buildings of the Space Research Foundation, the showy domes, the bright factories, the tidy lawns and paths. Nothing could have made them look so much like bits of colored paper.
That, I believe, is the fort, Chifoyalisk remarked, with his usual satisfaction at placing the tactless remark where it was least wanted.
Gone all to ruins, Paye said. Must be empty.
Want to stop and have a look at it, Shevik?
Chifoyalisk asked, ready to tap on the chauffeur's screen.
No, Shevik said. He had seen what he wanted to see. There was still a fort in Drio. He did not need to enter it and seek down ruined halls for the cell in which Odo had spent 9 years. He knew what a prison cell was like. He looked up, his face still set and cold, at the ponderous dark walls that now loomed almost above the car. I have been here for a long time, the fort said, and I am still here. When he was back in his rooms,
after dinner in the senior faculty refectory. He sat down alone by the unlighted fire. It was summer in AEO, getting on towards the longest day of the year, and though it was past 8, it was not yet dark. The sky outside the arched windows still showed a tinge of the daylight color of the sky, a pure, tender blue. The air was mild, fragrant of cut grass and wet earth. There was a light in the chapel across the grove, and a faint undertone of music on that lightly stirring air. Not the birds singing, but a human music. Shivik listened. Somebody was practicing the numerical harmonies of the chapel harmonium. They were as familiar to Shevik as to any Urasti. Odo had not tried to renew the basic relationships of music when she renewed the relationships of men. She had always respected the necessary. The settlers of Anaris had left the laws of man behind them, but had brought the laws of harmony along. The large, calm room was shadowy and silent, darkening. Shevik looked around it. The perfect double arches of the windows, the faintly gleaming edges of the parquet floor, the strong, dim curve of the stone chimney, the paneled walls, admirable in their proportion. It was a beautiful and humane room. It was a very old room. The senior faculty house, they told him, had been built in the year 540, 400 years ago, 230 years before the settlement of Anaris. Generations of scholars had lived, worked, talked, thought, slept, died in this room before Odo was ever born. The numerical harmonies had drifted over the lawn, through the dark leaves of the grove, for centuries. "I have been here for a long time," the room said to Shevik, "and I am still here. What are you doing here?" He had no answer. He had no right to all the grace and bounty of this world, earned and maintained by the work, the devotion, the faithfulness of its people. Paradise is for those who make paradise. He did not belong. He was a frontiersman, one of a breed who had denied their past, their history. The settlers of Anaris had turned their backs on the old world and its past, opted for the future only. But as surely as the future becomes the past becomes the future. To deny is not to achieve. The Odonians who left Urus had been wrong. Wrong in their desperate courage to deny their history, to forego the possibility of return. The explorer who will not come back, or send back his ships to tell his tale, is not an explorer, only an adventurer, and his sons are born in exile. He had come to love Urus. But what good was his yearning love? He was not part of it, nor was he part of it. Nor was he part of the world of his birth. The loneliness, the certainty of isolation that he had felt in his first hour aboard the Mindful, rose up in him and asserted itself as his true condition, ignored, suppressed, but absolute. He was alone here, because he came from a self-exiled society. He had always been alone on his own world, because he had exiled himself from his society. The settlers had taken one step away. He had taken two. He stood by himself because he had taken the metaphysical risk. And he had been fool enough to think that he might serve to bring together two worlds to which he did not belong. The blue of the night sky outside the windows drew his eyes. Over the vague darkness of foliage and the tower of the chapel, above the dark line of the hills, which at night always seemed smaller and more remote, a light was growing, a large, soft radiance. Moonrise, he thought, with a grateful sense of familiarity. There is no break in the wholeness of time. He had seen the moon rise when he was a little child, from the window of the domicile in Wide Plains, with Palat, over the hills of his boyhood, over the dry plains of the dust, over the roofs of Abani, with Tokfer watching it beside him. But it had not been this moon. The shadows moved about him, but he sat unmoving as Inaris rose above the alien hills at her full, mottled dun and bluish-white lambent. The light of his world filled his empty hands.